The power of algorithms. Algorithms are everywhere, in the news, inside our computers, and in other surprising places. Just this past week, a painting created by algorithms sold at auction for more than $400,000. I'm Cindy Hahn. Google continues to face questions about how it applies algorithms to prioritize what we see online. Some attribute the fluctuations in the stock market to investors using automated algorithms to make trading decisions. And of course, Facebook and Twitter, as well as other social media platforms, have come under scrutiny for the way their algorithms convey and prioritize political information to their users. Join me for a conversation about the surprising power of the simple algorithm and how it can shape the way we think and act. Main Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Cindy Hahn, and this is Maine Calling. Algorithm used to be a word you didn't hear that often, but today it's everywhere, from the stock market to advertising to social media. Joining me in the studio are three guests who will help us understand the far-reaching applications of algorithms and just what they are. Kim McKeag is an associate professor of data analytics and mathematics at Husson University. Penny Reingans is director of the School of Computing and Information Science at the University of Maine. And Judith Rosenbaum is assistant professor in the Department of Communication and Journalism, also with the University of Maine. And as always, we want to hear from you. Are you curious about how algorithms work? Have you noticed how they affect your life and in what way? Our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. And when we hear the term algorithm in conversation today, it usually has to do with information we're getting online and how that information reaches us. But the actual term and concept of an algorithm is much more straightforward. Isn't that right, Penny? It's actually a very basic kind of definition.
That's right. An algorithm describes something that starts with an input, does some process, and then produces some outputs. So you might think of something in your real life as an algorithm that didn't involve a computer, the process of making chocolate chip cookies. Your inputs, you've got the butter, the sugar, the flour, the chips. Your process is to cream the butter, add the sugar, add the flour, then to bake until it's golden brown, and the output that you get are the cookies. Algorithms and computers are similar in that they have those same three things of the input, the process, and the outputs. The kind of one particular kind of algorithm that I think we'll be talking about some is an algorithm that takes a bunch of input, as in observations from the world, and through some process, some computational process, makes a predictive model about how to make other identifications in the world and how to predict what's going to happen with particular people, whether they're going to succeed at college or default on a loan or something like that.
But it all starts, what you were describing with the recipe is really the same as coding, isn't it?
It's really the same as coding. The steps that you go through in the recipe are the same kind of steps that you would go through in an algorithm. You do things in a sequence. Sometimes you'll repeat them until a condition is true. And that's exactly what's happening in the heart of a program.
Okay. So at their very core, algorithms are nothing more than a set of instructions getting you from point A to point B.
Absolutely.
Okay, great. And Kim, your work takes algorithms to the next step. Is that right? It's sort of you're looking at data. And how does data analysis take this information?
That's right. In data analysis, we work with data both large and small, and we use algorithmic approaches to come up with models. Sometimes those models are predictions. So we might predict in marketing, for example, who's going to click on an ad and who's going to ignore that ad, so we can make sure that we send something to somebody that they're going to be interested in. We also have something called sorting algorithms, where we take a large group, typically of people, and we want to sort them into groups that are like one another but different from each other. And one of the really exciting things happening in the mathematical world of algorithms right now is some research to try to come up with a universal sorting algorithm.
What does that mean?
So that you'll be able to sort all kinds of data. We were talking earlier about some data is words, some data is numbers, and some data is pictures. And so data is coming to us in messier and messier forms. How do we come up with algorithmic approaches that will let us deal with that messiness?
Was this all happening before computers? Was there the ability to collect data on people and figure out how to target an ad to an audience?
Yes, but it was much more difficult to actually get decent feedback on the effectiveness of doing that. What big data and social networks have done is helped us get immediate, very large scale, very detailed feedback on how they're working.
Now that you mentioned big data, I did want to ask a little bit about that because that's a big part of this, right? Just the capability of getting so much information that it tells you more information because you have so much coming in.
You do. And the data in or inputs and then process and then outputs model is very important to keep in mind. A lot of the concern about algorithms lately and whether they're leading to biased results has taken into consideration or needs to take into consideration whether we're using good data and whether we're using all of the data we should or if we're only using a part of it because it's coming at us so fast that we're letting the machines sort it out in many cases rather than always having a human thinking about whether they're using the right things.
And that takes me to you, Judith, because you do look at social media and how all of this algorithmic functions basically sort what people are getting. Can you talk about, I think that's what most people think of when they think of algorithms, is how it's giving them the information that they get on Facebook or Twitter. How does that work and what's happening in the world of social media?
Well, I think what's really important to realize is that social media function is this important source of information for all of us. Even if you watch the national news every day or listen to, you know, Maine Public, you're still going to be on Facebook and see information about the world around you and about your friends. And we all live under this assumption that somehow we see everything that's out there in the chronological order in which it has happened. And in the past couple years, people have become aware that that's actually not what is happening, and that instead algorithms skew what we see. So you might have noticed that when you log into Facebook, you see posts from the same people over and over again, and you're wondering, where are my other, 348 friends? That's an algorithm. But like Kim was saying, and Penny too, part of the algorithm is determined by what we do. We are. Our behavior online is part of the input. So yeah, Facebook has an algorithm that determines what we see, but that algorithm is based in large part on our previous behavior. So if we've liked, say, the L.L. Bean page once, then Facebook's more likely to show us outdoor products. Or if I've liked Kim's page a whole bunch of times or what she's done, I'm going to see more of her posts. So yes, algorithms skew what we see for sure. But part of that is the result of our own behavior as well.
When Facebook is doing that, for example, I mean, we have this image of somebody watching us as we like someone's page, but are there measurable things that they're using to sort, such as how long you spend on an article or how many times? What sort of measures are there that sort people?
Yeah, there are incredible numbers of measures for any particular instance. What time of day you're on, what app you're on, obviously, whether you're a friend with a person, how long you spend on it, whether you click through to other things, and also information just about you, your demographics, are you male, female, your age, your educational level, background information about you, because the algorithms also can look and see if you are similar to other people on a lot of different dimensions, and then how that relates to your specific behaviors.
And what's really interesting is you mentioned looking at similarities. I think Facebook and other social media platforms are really built on the idea that that humans are herding animals, as I like to say. We're part of a group. We like to feel like we're with similarly minded people. And so these social media platforms try to create an environment where we feel that way, where we feel like we're surrounded by like-minded people because, the owners of these platforms reason that's what human beings like to do. The problem is that when it comes to politics or actual current events, a lot of us don't necessarily want to be surrounded by information we always constantly agree with.
And so that's how we get to this idea of polarization, that really people are blaming social media or algorithms, really, for how polarized our nation is right now with the information. But does it really boil down to algorithms?
I think that's too easy. I think that almost boils down to technological determinism, you know, blaming the machine. Yes, algorithms play a large role in the information that we see or don't see, and so they play a large role in what we know. But as humans, we can also take responsibility and say, I am in charge of my own information-seeking process. Maybe I do need to go to the main public website and read up on this story.
That would be wise. Trusted information. Where does machine learning fall? Again, these are all just terms, I guess, for what we've been talking about. But Penny, how do you differentiate machine learning from what we've been describing?
So machine learning starts with a lot of examples where you know a whole bunch of characteristics about something or somebody, and then you know some outcome. So you might know a bunch of things about a student, their SAT scores, their GPA, and then whether they get into a particular college. You can use, if you have tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of examples like that, where you know both the attributes and the outcome, you construct a model. And so that if you then have someone, hey, you have an example that you don't know the outcome for, you can predict what the outcome would be because you've seen so many examples of it in the past. And that's really what machine learning does.
And that is big data as well, right?
It works best because you have so many examples. And so that's part of why it has become more of a thing now than it used to be. A little bit of it's the computational power, and a lot of it is just the richness of the set of examples that are available now.
But this is where bias comes in, and there's been a lot of hubbub in the news over how this can steer, based on the data that you're getting, it can steer the results one way or another.
Absolutely. Both in two kinds of ways. One, in the ways in which you measure things about your examples. What is the pieces of information that you collect, say, about those students? And then also, what is the sample that you're looking at? But this is not a new machine learning problem. There was similar dynamic decades ago when medical experiments used to be, a lot of them would be run on soldiers. And what that meant is the medical models that they created of how does heart disease present only really worked for youngish men, right? Women present differently, and so the models didn't work for that because the input to these models was biased. And it's a very similar thing at a larger scale that's happening now with the machine learning models.
And the case that we always hear about is how judges will use information, or they have a program that they actually use to decide on somebody's sentence or how long they should be in jail. And it's based on data collected that ends up giving basically racist results because it's looking at how frequently somebody is being charged with a crime or being pulled over or whatever, and so it's skewing against the black population, and therefore they end up getting longer sentences because the judge is using that data.
Sure, or even subtler things like, do they know other people who've been incarcerated?
Mm-hmm.
And in some neighborhoods, that would be way more common than in other neighborhoods. And so people who live in those neighborhoods who might be poor, who might have a racial component to that, that gets baked into these models.
Recently, Google defended its use of algorithms to sort the links that appear when you do a Google search. So they said they're a search engine, not a news publisher. They can't be responsible for, you know, what comes up. But again, is there bias when you're looking at something like this massive thing like Google using algorithms to determine what link pops up when you type in a search word?
Yeah, you know, I think Google has done some things recently, including getting more human intervention into looking at what they have for content and what's coming up, because they are realizing that the fact that they're using specific data that has a historical context that then ends up getting replicated into the search results and things like that means that you need somebody to take a critical look at that. And again, these are not necessarily new things, but they're scaling rapidly and in a very large way because we have big data. So we still need the human critical review and thought about what the results are. One of the dialogues right now is about fairness. Like, how do you measure the fairness of the results that you get? And if you measure it by whether you just sort of get the same results for different groups, that's one thing. But if you measure it by the actual impact on people's lives in different groups, then you might see unfairness that you wouldn't see just based on the numbers.
So human judgment and intuition, things like that, still kind of are more powerful
still important.
Than a machine. I heard that with stocks right now, there was an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal saying that as much as stock traders, investors are using these programs now to kind of make their trading decisions, that sometimes it's the gut instinct that, or again, human intuition that is really better.
And a check on the process.
A check on that. Okay. Mm-hmm. Are machines getting to the point where they are programming themselves? Is this a sort of a cyclical thing where it's not like a person really is doing all on social media sorting things, right? So the machine's programming itself.
No, so I wouldn't say that. I think a person writes the set of instructions for how that sorting happens. And then the computer executes it. And so the computer will do exactly what you tell it to, maybe not exactly what you intended it to, and that's a communication problem. But there's still human control to this point over most of what we see. There's research. There are areas where you can have self-modifying programs and the programs can change the programs. That's not most of what we're seeing.
Then when you get to something like, there's so many applications of algorithms, I guess with self-driving cars, there's a human programming these cars to make a decision. Mm-hmm. And so the classic example you hear is, say, there's an elderly woman walking across the street and there's a school bus full of kids and it has to swerve. You know, what do you program it to decide in that situation? So how is that ultimately a human decision that has to be, the car has to be told what to do?
It's ultimately a human decision. In the code, it might not be that sort of ethical dilemma of which one do you hit. It might just be about size. It might be about something that seemed like it was.
There goes the elderly woman then, right? But you're right. So you're saying there's still a choice that a human makes in order for the machine to make its choice.
Right. And part of one of the core choices is the human in the designing of the algorithm decides what to consider.
Mm-hmm.
Right. What choices to build in, what decision points to build in. And that influences a lot of ways what kinds of outcomes you get.
Okay, we'll pick up on that thought, but we just have to take a quick break. So when we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do the law offices of Joe Bornstein. A statewide practice representing injured and disabled Mainers since 1974, joebornstein.com. And Otelco, formerly OTT Communications, from phones to fiber, serving Maine businesses for more than a century. Otelco.com. Maine Public is very pleased to be a media sponsor of the 2019 Camden Conference. This year's theme is This China's Century? And takes place this winter from February 22nd to the 24th. Registration opens to the general public November 26th, but Maine Public members can register now. For information, visit our website, mainepublic.org, and click on Events. Here's what's coming up today on our Your Vote 2018 debate schedule. On Maine Public Radio this afternoon at 2, we'll bring you the first district congressional debate. Over on Maine Public Television this evening, first at 8, it's the first district congressional debate. And then at 9, we'll bring you the gubernatorial debate. Our complete broadcast schedule for both radio and television, including this weekend's debate broadcasts, are at mainepublic.org. Click on Your Vote.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Cindy Hahn. Today on the program, we are learning about algorithms and how they affect us. Joining me in the studio, Penny Reingans, UMaine's Director of the School of Computing and Information Science, Judith Rosenbaum with UMaine as well. She's Assistant Professor in the Department of Communication and Journalism. And Kim McKeag is with Hudson University, where she's Associate Professor of Data Analytics and Mathematics. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. We were in the middle of talking about sort of the ethics of the algorithms that go into play in decision making. And Kim, you wanted to make a point about how that's coming into focus in the world of computing.
Well, and specifically, we were talking about self-driving cars, and there was just an article that came out recently about some people who are doing research globally about how we should prioritize these dilemmas so that it can go into the programming for self-driving cars. And they're asking people, for example, if you are about to hit a pedestrian, is it more important to save the pedestrian or to save the driver? Or if it's an elderly person versus a school bus full of children, how do you prioritize that? And what they're finding are there are some universal things, like people generally value human lives over animal lives, mm-hmm. So it's okay to hit the squirrel, apparently.
Especially this year.
There's going to be some people unhappy about that, but that seems to be kind of universal. But then there are these really interesting different country-wide or culturally-based variations. So in some cultures, older people are more valued than they are in some other cultures. What are we going to do with that, right? Are we going to have a universal standard for the whole globe, or are we going to need to shape our algorithms for the country in which you're driving?
Self-driving cars might act differently in Asia than they would here.
Right.
Yeah. So yeah. It's society deciding these things more than the machines, in a way, in the first place.
Which I find comforting.
Okay, good. Judith.
Yeah, we were talking about this over the break a little bit, right? The need for people to still have some level of media literacy so that when they log into Google or Facebook, they know that what they see is based on what they've done in the past, their demographics. And so everybody has a responsibility to just keep themselves informed. But at the same time, I also think it's important to protect those who might not be so internet savvy. People who might not be familiar with the internet, people who might not have had the education to really distinguish like skew and bias from neutral and objective. And so it's easy to say, and I know I said this myself not 10 minutes ago, people need to maintain responsibility for what they see online. But at the same time, we also need to hold these big corporations to some level of responsibility, because we can't expect all citizens to know the ins and outs of algorithms like the three of us do on this side of the table.
Right. We have a related email from Paul, and he says, when the answer to a question is only yes or no, it can only split the outcome onto opposite ends of a wide spectrum. A year ago, I created a second Facebook account using a different name. I then liked a few posts that normally I would disagree with. My news feed was then flooded with information opposite to my true political views. It was shocking how quick it happened and how successful Facebook's algorithms were to point me in an extreme direction.
And this is so true. I've done the same thing on Twitter. I tried to follow people from a very wide array of political backgrounds. And in the past couple weeks, I apparently have liked people from one particular political party because the news organizations whose posts I'm seeing first on Twitter now has changed.
Oh, interesting.
So, and there are codes you can put into Twitter that will change your timeline to be most recent only. But again, that's something you have to know. And it's a scary prospect.
What do you even mean when you say codes that you put in?
It's like a little, like a computer code that tells Twitter, only show me recent. Do not base what you show me on what I've liked in the past or recently.
Huh, okay. Another email from Brett this time. I'd love to hear your guests talk about how the results of many algorithms are beyond the comprehension of the people that create them. Is that true?
I think it's true. This gets back to the problem of scale, that it's very hard for people to have a good intuition of what it means to have a million samples and what might be captured in that. And building an algorithm, building a process for melding those into a model can result in surprising results. Some of those surprises are true surprises, and some of them are misleading surprises. And I think it is very hard for developers who even have wrote the code, who understand what's going on, to sometimes understand the results, because the interactions between things can be subtle and at a scale that's hard for us to comprehend.
There are plenty of movies and books out about artificial intelligence and how it can really start to think on its own and teach itself what to feel or think. Does machine learning lead to artificial intelligence to that degree?
Perhaps. I mean, that's an active philosophical battle going on. We're not at that point yet, and people take different sides of that in informed ways.
So you're my definitions person. What is the difference between machine learning and artificial intelligence?
Machine learning is a part of artificial intelligence. Artificial intelligence is a much broader umbrella of things that originally were about getting computers to behave like humans. And so typically it also included things like being able to understand human speech and process that into the words and the concepts that make it up, or understanding images, or planning how to accomplish something. And none of those things would normally be called machine learning. Machine learning is really this process of having lots of examples and using them to generate a model.
Okay, we'll go to a call from Elizabeth now from Bangor. Hi, Elizabeth, you're on Maine Calling.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure. What was it that you wanted to talk about?
Yeah, I just wanted to point out one thing and then make a book recommendation if I could. So earlier on the show, somebody had mentioned the L.L. Bean example where, you know, Facebook will show you ads if you like the L.L. Bean page. You might see in your feed suddenly ads promoting L.L. Bean sales and that sort of thing. And while that is true, that is a fairly simplistic way of looking at how Facebook uses our data to sell ads. Last year, Facebook reported $39.9 billion in ad revenue. They didn't get that because, you know, we all like all the companies that we see in our news feed. They get that because our data is worthwhile to advertisers so that we can be pinpointed down to not just age, gender, sexual orientation, and political beliefs, but also our favorite TV shows and TV shows our friends like, and that's used to sell us products. And that's incredibly valuable to companies like Facebook. It's not just us saying, yes, I'm okay with getting LL Bean ads in our feed. That's really not how they make money. The other thing I wanted to do is make a quick book recommendation that I think listeners might be interested in. It's called 10 Arguments for Deleting Your Social Media Accounts Right Now. It's by Jerome Lanier, and it's an excellent book. It does a deep dive into economic arguments, social arguments, psychological arguments around social media and some of the other topics that you're talking about regarding algorithms today.
Okay, great, Elizabeth. Thanks for letting us know about that. Penny?
So I think Elizabeth has a particularly good point about Facebook. It's even more true when you start thinking about Google. We tend to think of Google as being the source of truth, the source of where the facts come from. And I think we're much less likely to try to unpack what might be behind that. And so the problems with biased samples get amplified. But also, like Facebook, Google is in the business of selling ads. They're in it to make money. They're not here to be the arbiters of truth. And if we're expecting them to be something that they're not, there's a danger in that.
We have a related email about that, actually. This is from Scott. As it relates to a free society in a time where transparency is being called for by people of all political leanings, do the guests of today's show believe that there's a need for the developer of an algorithm to insist that their work be made freely available to the public, or a nonpartisan academic organization for verification of non-biased behavior? Having a check, basically, right, on something like Google. Is that something that ought to be there?
Ethically, I think that sounds wonderful. You know,
is it realistic?
Well, that I don't know, but it does sound like it would be a great example of how to keep things transparent so that at least we know what is being biased, what is being skewed, what about us is being sold to third parties.
And that seems to be the big problem right now, is that transparency issue.
Right.
Kim?
Related to that, I think Europe is doing it very differently right now in terms of, you know, their requirements for disclosure about your data being used, mm-hmm. and requirements to gain permission for the use of your data. It's not making the algorithms transparent necessarily, but as we were mentioning before, you know, in many cases, people are not going to understand the algorithms or how they came about. But you know, we could work on the data side of it and what people are willing to give up and really making it more clear how valuable that information is that you're just giving people right now.
Penny, you also wanted to add to that.
So building on that, I'm perhaps less optimistic that by being transparent about the algorithms, we're going to solve the problem, because I'm less willing to guess that the problem is in the algorithms. I think the problem with the biased data behind the algorithms is going to be a much larger problem. There was a recent example where Amazon was using a machine learning method for analyzing the resumes of who they're going to follow up in and who they might hire. So this is something where they very much wanted the best possible results because they were doing it for themselves. And what they found is that the models that they had trained over all these examples of historic resumes that had been submitted and the decisions about whether to interview them or not that had been made, those decisions were originally made by humans. When the models were trained from those examples, what they realized is that the machine learned models now represented gender bias. And they discriminated against people who were on the women's chess team or had gone to a couple of well-known women's colleges. They incorporated the human bias in the training data. Being transparent about the algorithm isn't going to help that.
So it's depends on the data, again, or how old it is, or, you know, if it's not relevant to today's time or
the human programming it.
Right. Okay. And you mentioned that. I mean, it was kind of alarming in doing the research for the show that really credit card companies, cable service, all kinds of things, the algorithm will kick in even to calculate the rate that you pay. So it's not particularly fair, is that? But that sets up the algorithm to be kind of the bad guy, and we keep hearing of it in that way. And what are some examples of good algorithms at work in society or in the media? I was, as an example, saying Spotify or something where it goes and it sorts out the music you might like, right?
Netflix is another example.
Okay.
But then again, I'm one of those people who likes to see different things at different times depending on my mood, and Netflix can't predict that.
So again, the human element, it's right. Not quite there. Okay.
And I think, you know, disease detection and prediction, you know, clinicians were the people who have traditionally diagnosed medical problems and diseases, and they have an array of tests, but they don't have the wealth of experience that a computer database could have on thousands and millions of humans and how different conditions come together to indicate diseases.
Okay, Henry has emailed something similar to that. He says, when computers are programmed to make life or death decisions, we are all at greater risk. What is missing is human judgment and experience. A number of commercial aircraft have experienced uncontrolled flight as a consequence of flight computers making flawed decisions. Only with great skill and improvisation have pilots been able to bypass computer controls in order to save the aircraft and its passengers. A famous Qantas incident over the Pacific comes to mind. Humans are flawed, but we hand over our power to computers at our peril. Penny, you're nodding.
I am. I would agree with that. I think that the human and the computer both have a role in this relationship, and each one has to bring to it what it does best. The computer brings best at being replicable and dealing with very large amounts of things and making decisions quickly. The human brings that element of judgment, that better idea of what to expect and that idea of ethics and what should happen.
Okay.
It's Judith. A trade-off, really. It's like a caller mentioned earlier, you know, we use Facebook, we use Twitter for free because our data are being sold. We accept the algorithms because we like being able to say hi to our grandma online. We like the ease of using computer systems to fly planes, but it comes with a trade-off. And the question is, where do you draw that line? We don't want to drive from Bangor to Portland. Are we willing to have the risk of hitting that older lady as opposed to a school bus when we're driving down here in our self-driving car? You know, where's the trade-off? I think as a society, we need to ask ourselves that question.
Okay. We're going to take another quick break, but first, a word about tomorrow's show. Join host Keith Shortall and Commissioner Pat Kelleher for a conversation about the status of Maine's marine resources. Email your comments and questions to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet us, or post to our Facebook page. Or you can leave a voicemail before the show at 207-370-3300. 3487. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Evergreen Home Performance, helping homeowners address climate change with energy audits, window replacement, and insulation. More at evergreenyourhome.com. The Bar Harbor Airport, offering daily flights to Boston all year long. More information at bhbairport.com. And Maine Masonic Charitable Foundation, supporting Maine Public Radio's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine.
The November election is just around the corner, and as part of our comprehensive Your Vote 2018 coverage, Maine Public Radio and Television are presenting a series of candidate debates. Coming up, our first congressional district debate. All of our debates are being shown multiple times on Maine Public Radio and Television and are always available online, along with candidate profiles, their positions on the issues, and one-on-one interviews. That's at mainepublic.org/yourvote.
And that first district debate coming up at 2 o'clock following Maine Calling.
I'm Jonathan Capehart. If politics is your favorite reality show, or if you're just trying to keep up with the frantic pace of the midterm elections, we've got you covered. Join me every Monday through Thursday for America on the Line, a live news and call-in show. We'll have the latest political news, analysis, and your calls on the issues that will matter most to you when you cast your ballot. America on the Line, a national conversation.
America on the Line is heard at 8 each Monday through Thursday evening leading into the election, and the rebroadcast of Maine Calling will follow at 9 o'clock.
Welcome back. I'm Cindy Hahn, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, how algorithms affect us all. Joining me today, Judith Rosenbaum with the University of Maine, Kim McKegg with Husson University, and Penny Reingans, also with UMaine. Join our conversation. Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-399-3566. And Kim, you wanted to pick up on the point that we were talking about before the break.
Yes, this point about, we really like being able to check in with grandma online, I think is a really important one and relates back to what I was saying earlier about how Europe is handling data. What we have right now is a situation where you have two choices. You either opt into Facebook as it exists so that you can check in with grandma, or you opt out. And there's not this sort of middle ground where you can say, I'm not comfortable with these elements of things, and the service is valuable to me, but is it valuable enough to give that up?
So California recently adopted a plan that's very similar to what Europe is doing with you have the right to opt out of data being sold to third party. You have the right, I believe, to see what data is being collected about you. And what was interesting is that when you look at other media that we use to communicate, like telephones, for instance, those have regulations. So you can enter your phone number into the Do Not Call registry. And then if all goes well, you don't receive any sort of, unwanted phone calls. It's regulated by the federal government. Social media are not. And, that's an interesting question to consider is do we want that? Do we at least want to be able to get away from this you're either in or you're out and have some sort of continuum?
It's still the Wild West with social media. There really isn't much regulation. I'll go to Marty now. He's calling from South Portland. Hi, Marty. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. So good to be on the show, and it's a great program. I've been enjoying everything I've been hearing.
Great.
A little background. I've been using computers since 72 and worked on them professionally for 3 decades. I'm very sensitive about having my personal information put online ever since my email address got harvested and spam started appearing. But the point I wanted to make was concerning people don't realize that the decisions they make as to what to reveal is based on the current environment in which they're making it. For example, there's an old adage, give me 6 lines penned by the most honest of men, and I will find sufficient by which I may hang him. That's going back. You're familiar with that? Yeah. So what seems benign now is one thing, but we've witnessed in recent years, not to mention any names, but a drastic change in the political environment. And so things that didn't seem to be any big deal, well, if the powers that be change and they selectively choose certain elements from my online history, for example, they can paint a picture very different than reality. And trying to protect myself from those selective choosings becomes very problematic. And I'd love to hear your comments on that. Thank you.
Thank you for your question, Marty. Judith.
So, thank you, Marty. I think you're talking about how difficult it is to create an online presence that reflects who you are. And, you know, it is really easy for social media platforms to paint people as, you know, one-dimensional, focusing on, are you a Republican? Are you a Democrat? Do you like the Red Sox or, heaven forbid, the Dodgers, you know? But I think with the way social media platforms are structured and the way they are based on algorithms, you know, when we, even as a social scientist, when we collect data, we look to check boxes. And so that's what social media platforms do. You know, they don't necessarily look at the intricacies of, you know, what you had for breakfast this morning or why one election you voted this way and another election you voted another way. And so I think the use of computers in that regard and the way we harvest data that way, it simplifies who we are as human. It doesn't simplify who we are, but it simplifies how we are seen by others.
Right. Okay, Marty, thanks for the great question. And now we'll go to Cynthia calling from Winthrop. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a quick question in regards to the algorithms that we are learning to understand. I'm kind of a neophyte in understanding them a little bit. Just the other day, I was talking to a business in regards to what was showing on their Facebook page in regards to how events were falling and what was coming up on the page and the equity of it. And the individual that I was speaking with said that, oh, there was nothing they could do about their Facebook page because it was all based on algorithms, and they had no way of changing what the algorithms were put into place by Facebook, et cetera, et cetera. And I kind of felt like they were blaming or maybe not taking responsibility for what shows up on their page on the algorithms that Facebook put into place for them. And I was wondering if that's actual or if, based on what I've been listening to on your program, is if it's the program or who's putting the information into their Facebook page. Can they influence it, or is it truly just what comes up on their page is based on algorithms, as they kind of said that was what was happening?
Great question. What do you say?
So that's a good question. Probably both. It's unlikely that they could control that algorithm themselves, so they're not doing that. It's also unlikely that the programmers built in how selections were made. And so this is probably another example like what we've been talking about, how that business provided a bunch of possible things that could come up. They have a bunch of events, a bunch of products, something like that. They provide that set, but they probably don't control how selections get made out of that set.
Okay, so it's not quite as, I mean, it's true. People automatically blame Facebook. Oh, that darn algorithm, why am I seeing this?
So right, and it comes down to often what are you selecting from? Were your set of examples, were the set of things that were available, was that a biased set?
Mm-hmm. And there are ways on Facebook to click a star at the top of organizational pages that tells Facebook, I want to see this first. So I did that with the Bangor Police Department and their Duck of Justice. So All of their posts I see, regardless of Facebook's algorithm.
Okay. Where is that star?
I think if you go to the page, if you see a post from that page, on the top right hand, there's those three little dots. I think if you click on that, drops down a menu and you can click see this first.
Okay.
I believe. I don't have my phone on me right now.
But you were saying earlier the inverse is not true. There's no such thing as a do not call list for Facebook or social media.
You can create an ad blocker, or you can put an ad blocker on your web browser so that you don't see ads. So I have that. So my Facebook and Twitter are very, very bare. You can also use an incognito browser, which means they don't track where you are or who you are. And that kind of prevents these platforms from, to a certain degree, harvesting, collecting data on you.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, your behavior on the platform will still give a lot away about who you are.
Okay. All right. And now we will go to Anna calling. She's driving right now. Hi, Anna. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. I think that this is a great topic. I also work in predictive modeling and algorithm development in medical informatics for a pretty large company that sells this kind of product to hospitals. And I think it's interesting because everyone sees gathering data as something somewhat negative, I feel like, and that's a lot of the tone that's going around today. But I think that, like, there are so many different uses and applications for these types of work that people tend to overlook, especially in medicine. We're working in disease prevalence and predictive modeling for risk assessment, and ultimately those impact a lot of the experiences that patients have in hospitals these days when they're using applications like ours. So I just wanted to throw it out there that while people definitely feel like, oh, their privacy is essentially being intruded upon, there's actually a lot of good in the work that people have put forth in this area.
Anna, thanks for making that point. And do you see in your work that this is happening more frequently, that people don't realize?
That's interesting. It's on the aggregate level, because the topic is so big and complicated and healthcare data is so difficult, right? I think that it definitely goes a little bit underappreciated and misunderstood.
Mm-hmm.
People get paranoid that you're harvesting their medical information for reasons that they associate with intrusion of privacy because of the conversation we're having around social media data. And it's true that we are looking to integrate social determinants data into our models often. So again, we're doing this for purposes of good. And we're finding that many times the software is really good at detecting issues patients could be having. That's kind of the point.
Okay, thanks, Anna, for the call. And Penny, you were just talking about also that, you know, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. There are a lot of good applications
sure,
of this type of modeling.
There's one in particular that gets called learning analytics. So it's machine learning applied to the educational process. And it can be used in ways that make us concerned, like making predictions of this student will succeed, this student won't succeed, so we'll not admit these, not admit those. And the algorithm will make wrong conclusions sometimes. There'll be both false positives of those who it predicts are going to succeed who won't, and false negatives of those who would do well, who are not admitted. But you can use that process in a different way, which has less loaded outcomes, less loaded impact. And what you might do is you might use it to study a group of people, students who looked like they shouldn't succeed and did, and learn, can you from them identify common things that they did, and can you use the algorithm to reproduce the good that people have done rather than just being a force for concern?
Kim, what did you want to say about that?
Well, you know, I think that the don't throw the baby out with the bathwater is a really important message here, and I want to echo that, because we're going to collect data. We sort of can't help it. And we're going to build algorithms and try to do good things with them. The point is, we need to make better algorithms, and we need to remember to keep the human in them, and we need to teach. We're all educators. We need to teach our students to do this in the most responsible, most ethical, and best way possible. That's what we're really about. So it's not that all algorithms are just bad. It's like, can we make better ones?
And Anna made another really valid point. She said patients think that, you know, we're taking their electronic medical records. But there's kind of an advantage with the large numbers that we're all working with. Most of that data is de-identified. It's not as though Facebook knows, although they will now, that I had Eggos for breakfast this morning. But they'll know that people like me might have Eggos for breakfast in the morning. So it's not that they link all of this data to you as a person. It's just that they create categories of people like you who show behaviors like you. So it's not as though there's this big brother with this big database out there. Maybe there is, and maybe these two women here are going to tell me that there are. But I don't think there's a big database out there with all the things that Judith does and has and likes.
Same thing when people worry about the smart home devices listening in on them, right? It's a big, huge chunk of data out there. We'll go to Anne now. She's calling from South Portland. Hi, Anne. What's your question?
Hi. my background is kind of eclectic. Most recently, I was a software tester, but I also have a background in science as well as a lot of experience in medicine, and in as well as some early experience as a telephone answering service operator. And in none of these arenas have I not met a lot of people who thought they were infallible. And I feel like a lot of this conversation has kind of sidestepped the human element of algorithms. You talked about it, but I really feel like we've got to make very sure we're not blaming algorithms for what goes wrong when they're used. It's the humans who coded them, who had their acknowledged or unacknowledged biases when they wrote the algorithms that caused the issues with them.
Okay. Thanks, Anne. And you did all touch upon that. Did anyone want to respond to Anne's point?
Well, I can expand on one of the things I was thinking about earlier related to this is, you know, this is still kind of the Wild West. It's an old field in many ways, but it's still very new in other ways. And, you know, we developed these sophisticated algorithms that look very simple and elegant, and they're pretty easy to use. And then I think sometimes what happens is we take an overly simplistic approach to the application of them, and we forget to sort of go back and do the check and say, okay, now what are the consequences intended and unintended of actually using this thing? And I think as the field has matured, now is where we're starting to get that level of dialogue and discourse into things. So that's an excellent point.
Well, that leads me to my question. What does the future hold? Are we just learning more about how to do this correctly?
I think we are. I think we're also learning about where we can use it, right? It's not even so much the how do we make the technology better, it's how do we use it better. Where are the places that we haven't yet imagined that we can make the world better through this kind of technology?
That's a great point to end on. Thank you all for joining us. Kim McKegg is an associate professor of data analytics and mathematics at Hudson University. Penny Reingans is director of the School of Computing and Information Science at the University of Maine. And Judith Rosenbaum is assistant professor in the Department of Communication and Journalism with the University of Maine. John Keimel ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as helpful links and resources, by visiting mainecalling.org. Today's show will be broadcast again tonight at 9. And a reminder, as Election Day comes up, you can find all the Maine Calling Your Vote candidate interviews at mainepublic.org. I'm Cindy Hahn, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.